Hello.
Hello.
See, I said I was going to do something different this time, and then I just didn't.
Yeah, you're checking it out.
No, I just remembered halfway through
Bok, bok, bok,
again.
bok, bok, bok.
Don't you dare call me a chicken.
What's the matter, McFly?
Yeah. Cat got your McFly? That how cats work? And or McFlies?
I don't know. Although I am looking forward to the future where McDonald's starts making like insect patties because we've run out of other proteins, and then we'll have a McFly.
You think they're gonna go from like beef and chicken to bugs?
I don't know. Just be a fun dystopian take on it, I guess. We'll wait for a Mike Judge movie about it. Idiocracy
Think
2.
they're gonna go with like lab grown stuff. I think I saw a thing about growing beef in a lab,
Just as God,
which
God intended.
seems weird. Yeah, well, sure. I mean, God made the scientists that are making the lab grown beef, so circle of life or whatever.
Speaking of lab grown beef, Suicide Squad.
It's a reasonable transition, to be honest. Where do we start with this? Do we start with how did this happen? This is obviously a result of the Avengersification of filmmaking. It's not enough just to have superhero movies. You got to have movies where all of the superheroes get together and do extra superhero stuff. And then, or you could put a bad guy hat on a hat, and then make your group of superheroes technically anti-bad hero bad guys, and make sure everyone says bad guy a lot in the movie. But it's same thing. It's a group of people fighting stuff. I'm struggling to think back to 2016 when this was announced and it was coming out, and everyone was like, "Ooh, interesting. There's no way they're gonna do it. I can't believe they're gonna do it. Suicide Squad, bro. It's gonna be so cool. I can't believe they got the guts to try this."
Well,
And then I did it, and it's just, neon colored badness.
yeah, so the to answer your first thing, which I think is also the problem with the actual result, is that this is based mainly around corporate motives, and I don't mean like the same way like Kevin Feige's like this dictatorial tyrant who directs all the Marvel stuff and like positions things in different phases for how they'll roll out stuff and like dictates things about the cut and like what things need to integrate with what movies and what you are and aren't allowed to have in your Marvel movies or whatever. No, over at DC, they just kind of have a bunch of random executives who come and go and kind of change and alter the agenda as is their whim on their way through this process. So at some point, they were like, "Hey, we should have like money like Marvel has, because we make these comic books too. This is the same stuff. We can just turn them into movies. You just push the make movie button." So
Look at all this IP. We got a machine to print money.
And then they're like, all you need to do is just say, "Hey, you go make a movie," and they make it for you. So that's what they decided to do, and they had the David Ayer make this thing.
And David Ayer is, I know this name. I should have clicked on him beforehand, but he wrote End of Watch, which I think I've seen most of. He wrote something called Sabotage. And I thought I knew who he was. I don't know who he is. Oh, he wrote Training Day. Okay, that makes sense.
I
It
mean,
doesn't make sense, but I like that movie.
well, I mean, he has a hardcore bro-y vibe to his stuff, I guess, is the big takeaway. So David Ayer, he's brought in to do this, to direct and write the film. It's always a dangerous combination, whenever you do that. But the studio didn't quite understand what they would be getting from the process, and he didn't quite understand that he was walking into a trap. So they both didn't quite accomplish what they were setting out to do.
What was the trap? And was the trap shaped like lightning shooting into the sky?
No, the trap was that this was a movie studio with just a bunch of randos who will just, you know, on the drop of a hat, just change their minds on things. So they don't really have any like good planning or guts or anything. So they'll just pivot at a moment's notice, and you'll just get a bunch of random stuff from all kinds of directions. And that's very evident by this process that it went through. Because this was
there's like two modes where things can go off the rails. It's where like the IP money print machine hasn't quite like gotten full head of steam yet, so they're gonna like, you know, let's keep tweaking the idea, let's keep brainstorming. And then there's the after you've started to make the thing and you're like, oh no, this is going off the rails, let's throw every possible idea at it to see if that can improve it. So there's like multiple places where they could have a bad time and just try stuff, and I think they probably went through both of those phases on this movie.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you know, so I will just say, having watched this film finally, after sort of resolving never to do that,
five years late, but it's okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's the rush? Because I've come to the conclusion that yes, they're both wrong. I don't think that there is a good David Ayer version of this, despite the release of the David Ayer cut and his comments that he didn't really get a fair shake, and that there is.
Oh right, he went Snyder and said that he's got a real good version of this movie, and they just didn't release it.
Yeah, and then Anand Sarnoff said, "No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to ever release that."
Well, I guess that's not called getting Snydered, because he actually got his out. That's what getting tranked. He's a Fantastic Four guy, right?
No, David Ayer wasn't. He didn't quite get ejected from this process exactly the same way as Trank did, but it just has some similarities. Because David Ayer, I don't think that there is a good version of this, despite what he may think of it. I don't think he has the taste. What is in the film, I wouldn't want to see more of. So I can't imagine any method for splicing or cutting together or rearranging this that would improve it, because the fundamentals of it are broken. And even the basic components, when put together, like dialogue, are travesties. So it's, and I use travesty like plural, like, because there are multiple like cliches and sins like going on here in terms of like, you know, trying to assemble an entertaining piece of film. Because, like, this isn't something where you're making an art house picture. You're like, it's a different set of standards. Like, is this thing entertaining and fun? Like, I feel like the bar for that is probably a little lower. I just don't think he can clear that bar. And I don't think he was set up for success or helped by the post-production process. But I don't think that if he had the money that he wanted and the decisions that he wanted, we would be sitting here going, wow, what an amazing film we just watched.
I'm going to agree with you by disagreeing slightly, by saying that I think there is a version of this movie that could exist, probably not the one that he claims exists. I believe there is a version of this movie that could exist that is better than what I just watched for 2 hours. It probably requires an additional 30 minutes of your attention, because it probably needs to be cut like a movie and not like a 2 hour long trailer or a music video. But I think if you reduce the amount of sin related vectors, if I can use a phrase that's not a real phrase, by taking the editing out of that equation, I think there's a movie here that is more palatable. Because, you know, I'm on board with this like dirty, grungy, neon bad guy kind of concept, but
nope.
First of all, it's just needle drop after needle drop of song, most of which are used in the most cliche form possible, right down to Creedence Clearwater Revival and the Helicopters. The dialogue is atrocious. Like, it is like, we don't have a script yet, but we need some footage for a Comic-Con trailer, like, level cheesy. And maybe because there's like nothing else to like pay attention to or look at, all we're doing is like looking at people sort of like taking two steps into frame and turning to somebody else and saying quippy dialogue that like that makes it like extra insufferable to listen to. But like if it were edited a little better, if there were some like
but Dan, you're falling
if it
into
were paced better. Like it could be a better movie than it is.
Okay, but you're falling.
I'm not saying it would be a good movie. It's still a giant pile of poop.
Yes, but see, this is the trap. You are saying that you would come up with ways to subtly improve this thing, but this thing, is it worth improving? No.
No. It's just when it comes down to it, the plot of this movie is, cyclical and redundant and. The movie is a tautology. Like, the mission exists because the lady that asked for the mission is also the mission, and the people that are in it have ulterior motives, but are all their motives are also the motives that get into, like, none of it. It's a circle. It's all. There's no motivation. There's no payoff. There's no drama. Like, you see that there's even a couple of moments in the movie where there's supposed to be like dramatic reveals, but it undercuts itself there by revealing the reveal before you get to the reveal, and then just using dialogue to restate the reveal. And you know, they do everything at least twice, usually three times, whether it's a character introduction or a flashback or a discussion about the plan or whatever it may be. So the underlying infrastructure of this movie is made out of, I don't know, rotten toothpicks or something, but like, you know, it could have been entertaining if, well, I mean, you would have to do some fairly major reconstruction to the early pre-production stages, but like conceptually, there could have been a Suicide Squad movie that was entertaining. This is not it. This one could have been improved, but it would not have been good.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is like, you would have to so fundamentally change what this is that you would not arrive at anything like this. So,
well, you would have to change the story. I think the tone and the feeling and just the general vibe, I think that they have that down, which is why it feels like a trailer, because a trailer is all about just communicating a tone and a vibe to the audience. And that's all this thing does. But it wears on you because eventually that tone gets drowned out by the words that humans are saying. And you realize that the words are all very stupid words. And then they're just walking in a direction and not doing anything. So, you know, as soon as you start paying attention, you realize, no, thank you.
No. Well, I do slightly disagree with you on the vibe of this. I don't find the styling of this to be tasteful or all that well considered. I know a lot of effort went into it, because, you know, they just randomly get these things on screen. But I think a really big example of that is the Joker. Which I think is probably one of the worst things about the entire film. And
it really feels like it was committed to death.
But
and then Jared Leto just, you know, threw a pile of poop at it.
No, well, see, it was Jared Leto throwing a pile of poop at it, and then it got committed to death afterwards, because there was actually supposed to be more Joker in this movie that was removed. So that he got himself out of the picture because Warner Brothers executives didn't want to watch him is amazing.
Yeah, that's another one of the things that's like, it's the it in the movie, it's cyclical. Like, she wants to get out to see him, but she gets out and he rescues her from her mission to see him, but then he maybe dies, but then rescues her again. Every bit of the Joker in this movie is used incorrectly and horrible. I can't believe that laugh made it into the final cut.
No, well, and to go back to the stylistic point of that argument is like, the way they made him look like the Joker was they decided purposefully to set him apart and make him appear to be more of like a, you know, how should I say this? Like, he's tattooed and he has like, what are the metal, whatever, chrome things on his teeth. He's a mess. And it's just because they
he's a meth and cocaine fueled buff gangster wearing a shiny neon purple suit.
Yeah, it doesn't. And I know they're trying to like set him apart from the other Joker versions that have existed before, but just because you made something different doesn't mean you made it good. And this is not good. Even before you get to the part where Jared Leto's acting destroys it, he stylistically just isn't what you want out of a Joker. And I don't.
And again, I want to go on record as saying I think there could have been a better version of what he delivered if he had any words or actions to do that made any sense or had any consequence. It still would have been like, that's a real weird choice to go for the Joker in this weird kind of guy. And I don't really approve of what Leto is doing. But if you turned this character into the sort of violent anarchistic character that the Joker should probably be, maybe it would have been watchable, but at this point, it's just like you're kind of watching him out of the corner of your eye because you don't want to look right at it because it's too cringy.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that cringe is the relationship between the Joker and Harley Quinn. And that, you know, is this abusive, you know, codependent nightmare thing going on. The movie doesn't change anything about the relationship over the course of the picture.
No.
There is no...
And it's amazing how quickly they communicate the relationship and then repeat it into oblivion to the point that it becomes predictable and obnoxious.
Yeah, like, it doesn't... There is no new twist on their relationship here. There is no power shift, or there is no granting of agency or appreciation or realizing that you're in a bad situation. Nothing happens to move these characters in any sort of direction other than to the end of the film and into the next film. Like, they just are going in a basically straight line through everything else that's happening, unaffected by it. And the biggest part that could have affected something was when Harley Quinn thought that the Joker had died. We, the audience, know that was not, that didn't happen, but that we have to sit there and watch Harley be upset about it for a little bit, as it being a possibility. And then on the other side of that, at the end of the film, you know, he's alive and they're going to, you know, break out of there, etc. It doesn't have anything to do with the squad. The Joker doesn't really interact with the squad. He just happens to be shooting in a random pattern in order to get Harley out of there from the rooftop thing. But he doesn't have anything to do with Waller. He doesn't have anything to do with Joel Kinnaman's character. He doesn't interact with Will Smith, even though there is this feint at some sort of there are some sort of feelings between Will Smith's character and Harley Quinn, played by Margot Robbie, but they don't do anything with that, and it provides no conflict in the relationship between the Joker and Harley for Harley to see what some other emotions are like from some other source. So I ultimately don't know what the point of it was. To even put that in there. And
I mean, it's not just that, like, that's endemic of the whole thing. Like, the turn at the end where I don't even know the character's name, Fire Guy is like, you're my family, fam, and I'm gonna sacrifice myself for the fam because I love you guys and we're all bros and stuff, so it'll be okay. And then when Harley's like, you know, don't hurt my friends, I'm going to kill you, witch lady. First of all, they've been together for like 45 minutes of real world time. But also, we've not seen an ounce of, you know, friendship or shared experience that would bring any of these characters together that would indicate that these people who are lifelong criminals and been in prison for a long time would form any sort of lasting emotional bond, or even just the feeling of like loyalty toward one another. Absolutely none of that is formed here at all. So getting us to buy that is just, it's not going to happen. Let alone the fact that it's done in the most cliche way again, that it could possibly be done. So, you know,
yeah. And I think it was a huge mistake to start with there not being a team, and then trying to assemble the team for the picture rather than having the team exist and then having like one or two new people coming on to the team. And then using them as your audience proxy to explain why the team is the way it is and what missions they go on, et cetera.
But then you miss the 40-minute montage of look at how cool these bad guys were, and now they got to come together. And look at the, it's like seven different oils and waters is coming together.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to be crazy.
I mean, I clocked it, and it was 19 minutes and 56 seconds from when I hit play that we got to the end of the first set of character expositions and the end of like Waller explaining stuff at her steak dinner thing. And
yeah, the steak dinner where they all sort of sit around Illuminati style with big binders that say top secret.
Yeah, inside of an empty restaurant. So they, you know, have that thing happen and I'm like, fine, good, we're over, we're done with it. But then we're not done with it because they immediately go back into having the characters in the jail still, in the prison still, and that they're not even on the mission yet. There's some other stuff that needs to happen. And then
they talked about the mission and the characters at the steak dinner table, but then they had to go to the jail and explain the steak dinner conversation to the to the actual members of the squad. And then later they had to assemble the squad, and then there was more assembling of squad.
Yes, because when she goes to the prison with Joel Kinnaman, they don't actually take them to be a part of the squad. They're just visiting. And then
already the auditioning process, and then you get the Ike Barinholtz series of shots and things.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just irks me because that would have been the perfect opportunity to just bring them in and get the story going. But instead, yeah, what you do is you have them leave and leave the people who we are actually waiting to see do stuff inside of this prison. And then you have your main cast of characters go off to go convince people of the Pentagon. And then we, you know, start to set in motion what the actual bad guy thing is going to be. And the entire time, our characters are inside of a prison. And then the bad guy thing happens, and it's a reason for Enchantress to go into the field, and that goes wrong, and then they need to activate the Suicide Squad, Task Force X, actually. And when they activate Task Force X, we see a whole montage of them getting El Diablo and Deadshot and Harley Quinn and Captain Boomerang all together.
Don't forget, yeah, they get their neck pills or whatever, but Captain Boomerang just shows up in a bag.
Yeah, and Killer Croc is there, and then they, out of nowhere, reveal that, by the way, here's Slipknot, who is a man who can climb anything, and
yeah, what an amazing superpower.
And then and here's also Katana.
Katana's introduction is my favorite because it's literally just like the helicopter is leaving, and then you see the silhouette of somebody walking towards it, and she does a flip onto the back, and Joel Kinnaman is like, by the way, this is Katana, she's got my back, she'll kill you. Also, by the way, her sword steals the souls of people she kills. And it's just like, I'm sorry, you're just gonna throw that in as a line on the side?
Yeah, and then she gets a little Kill Bill flashback of her like revenge murder of some guy, which is why she was late to this. And it's just like, but why? Why are we still explaining who these characters are?
I had to steal the soul of the man who killed my husband and used the same sword that he used to kill him.
Yeah. And so we finally get through this whole entire process of explaining who all these bozos are, except Slipknot.
And boy, is my sword tired.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Slipknot does not really get an introduction other than, you know, saying he's a man who can climb anything, which is just ridiculous.
I wonder why he wouldn't get such an introduction. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense after 40 minutes of montage introducing the characters.
It's pretty obvious because he's gonna die. He's obviously the first person that gets killed. They also have an assortment of Navy SEALs, which seems to grow and contract based on the needs of the scene as written.
That's how the military works.
Yeah, just army of one or army of 12, army of 26. It doesn't really seem to have any sort of meaning, really.
Featuring the lesser Eastwood. I already forgot his name.
Scott Eastwood.
He's here. Was this the first one that really, like, he came out and he was like being an actor guy?
I don't know.
It's been so long since he's been sort of trying to do things that I think this was like the first. This was the breakout role for him.
Yeah. Well, my favorite part is that underneath Scott Eastwood, the blurb about his character on Wikipedia is a Navy SEAL lieutenant who assists Flag during squad's mission. Period. After working with actor Shia LaBeouf on Fury, Ayer originally sought him out for the role, but the studio was not interested in the actor. Could you imagine the two most important things about your character are that you are a Navy SEAL and that you were going to originally be cast to be somebody else who actually sucks? Like that's the old, those are your character attributes for the entire film. So
they figured they had a large enough debacle on their hands with this movie. They didn't need to add Shia to it at the same time,
I guess.
I love that Joel Kinnaman's character's last name is Flag, and they call him Flag. In case you were wondering, the guy who wears the hat with the flag on it the whole time and works for the U.S. government as a soldier, his name is Flag.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't believe Ayer wrote the name. Like, that. This is from a comic book. So you can be
stupid.
You'd be mad at the comic book people. But
I'm mad at the comic book people. I'm also mad at Joel Kinnaman for not being able to act at all.
Oh, God. He's so boring. I know we talked about this before with RoboCop. He's dreadful in RoboCop. And you're like, well, he's supposed to be a robotic human being who seems barely human, more machine-ish. And it's just like, oh, well, guess what? He sucks at that. But in this, he also like is bad at being like a person guy thing. Just there. He's supposed to be just like this vanilla guy. And he just...
Yeah. He did catch the brunt of a lot of exposition, though. Yeah. Like, his character obviously has a lot to do. Like, the ending scene, which, again, is supposed to be pivotal and dramatic... When Harley slices the Enchantress's chest open and steals the heart, he puts a hand on Will Smith, looks at him, and goes, "Her heart's out. We can end this." And then he goes over to his backpack, picks up some explosives, shouts at Croc, who is 2 feet away from him, "Croc," and hands him the explosives. And then Croc starts to move forward. And this is all in real time, kind of, too. And then they get into the slow motion where Harley throws the gun and Croc throws the bomb and then he gets the gun, and like it's the most awkwardly paced, horrible thing ever. But like, we already know that they have to remove the heart. So the whole like him putting the extra mustard on that hot dog and really sort of tapping Will Smith on the shoulder and saying, "Her heart is out, we can end this now." My God. The writing is so bad.
But that's the writing. I don't blame him for that. I blame him for...
Well, I mean, he can't sell it either. Like, no. He can't sell any of the things he has to say. Not all of them are that blatantly bad exposition-wise. Like, but like when he's face-to-face with Will Smith and they're trying to out-tough guy each other, you know, you're going to get a little bit of cheese factor in those kinds of scenes, but Will Smith sells it a million times better than Joel does. And it's just... It also doesn't help that Joel Kinnaman reminds me a lot of a guy I went to high school with who also likes to pretend he's a soldiery boy with guns and stuff, and he's also a giant idiot.
Yeah. So, you know, from an acting perspective, I just don't think that he brings anything to the table. But from a writing perspective, there was not much for him to carry to the table, I guess, because he's just not written to do much of anything other than to be this opposition. And to have this affection for June Moon, who is possessed by the Enchantress.
Sure, June Moon and the Enchantress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Dan, you got to stop. It's comic book names. Like, it's just going to be comic book
names. Well, I mean, the problem with June Moon and the Enchantress is not June Moon and the Enchantress. The problem is that Enchantress got out and she's ruling June Moon, and June Moon doesn't want to be the Enchantress, but Joel can't kill June Moon or the Enchantress because he really likes June Moon. But he's really got to get the Enchantress out. He's got to promise to kill the Enchantress so the Enchantress doesn't do anything bad. is what June Moon said. But then he kills the Enchantress to keep his promise to June Moon. But like, really, he should have just done that on day one, because apparently killing the Enchantress just means that you can peel her off like an exfoliating mask or something.
Yeah, I was curious about that choice to have it just be like this latex thing that splits apart on your face. I thought it was just mud or something, but I was like, why is it a piece of stuff?
It's Ghostbusters, but instead of clawing their way out of clay monster dogs, she just peeled it off. It was easier.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Enchantress just made a magic latex face mask because that was, you know, her favorite pastime for stuff. It's just like, you know, really
she's
really
a big
sell
fan
it.
Of Halloween, unsurprisingly.
Yeah. And the whole plan, basically, and to an earlier point that you had made about this movie being cyclical, the whole reason why this movie happens is because of Amanda Waller. Because
she puts together the team to rescue her once she accidentally gets captured by one of the members of the team that she set up to be on the team.
Yes. Which was the only member of the team that she was relatively certain that she could control, because she had the Enchantress's heart inside of a locked case. And, you know, turns out there were some other ways around that, especially when the Enchantress realized that there was the statue of her brother inside of the, like, computer nook, like closet office thing next to Amanda Waller's bed. And all she had to do was take that. So Amanda Waller just botched it, really. And so that's why all these people died. And
that's why a city was destroyed and lots of people died.
Lots of people died, including her subordinates.
They try to sort of play on the whole, like, These monstery things were humans once and were actually killing people, but they were turned into these monsters. But then they're like, oh, well, that's part of the mission. Now they have weird bug eye heads and we gotta go about our business and kill them all.
Yeah. I mean, kudos to them for, you know, trying to go this like cosmic horror route of, you know, like Cthulhu-esque whatever stuff with like the eyes and stuff. At least they weren't just...
Yeah, I hated it.
I mean, I'd rather have that than just like your typical zombie makeup stuff. That would have been boring. But
you like pulsating bubbly heads?
I mean, I don't like it. Like, I don't want one near me or anything. But that's the point of the film, is like, you need to make them seem suitably like otherworldly and also terrifying. And I just would not have been happy had it been like people with like black face paint and glowing eyes, or like, you know, zombie makeup.
I mean, they're supposed to be terrifying, and they say in the dialogue, like, they can take a bullet to the head and keep fighting, but at no point do we really see them posing any sort of a challenge to our characters.
Also, that line of dialogue is actually incorrect, because they take a bullet to the head and their head explodes. Every single time that happens, their head explodes. So, no. They don't keep on fighting when they take a bullet to the head. I don't know why Amanda Waller said that, but they are tenacious to a certain degree, and
they got a lot of pluck.
Yeah, and they have the converted SEAL team seems to have the machine guns, so that's something. But the you know, in terms of like how much of a problem they are, the fact that Captain Boomerang, who has a boomerang and a couple knives, can take them down, and it's just like, no, Captain Boomerang should have died instantly at the beginning of this film. He provides no comic relief. There's no character development for him. There is no character development that is caused by his presence. He doesn't do anything significant in the narrative. You could have eliminated his character from this, and it would have been basically the same film. So I don't know if he was written to have different scenes that were eliminated, or if this was really the intention, that you would just have this guy who was just supposed to be a jerk, and then he survives through the entire movie, even though he has no real skills.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was supposed to be there for comic relief. It was neither comedic nor relieving.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's in the next one too, right? So he must have done something, right?
I guess. I don't know. I mean, it seems kind of random, the people that are in the next one. Speaking of the next one, Will Smith. He is supposed to be one of the stars of this team. I mean,
he's arguably the main character of this whole stupid movie.
Yeah, I would say that Will Smith and Margot Robbie are basically the two sort of like leads of this team.
Mm-hmm.
And further down that list, you have Joel Kinnaman and Viola Davis. But then way down on the list, you have literally everyone else who just does almost nothing, gets no character development. And Will Smith doesn't get character development either. He
gets some more backstory and he gets to talk in his backstory. So he almost gets some character development.
I don't like his child, though. And his,
I don't think that's unique to his child.
No, his daughter is his reason for all the stuff in his life, basically. It's the reason why he's captured by Batman, which was a flashback I did not need. Ben Affleck as Batman getting shot, going, and then falling down. Ben Affleck is in this movie four times. Yeah. And Ezra Miller is in it once as the Flash, but
mm-hmm.
the daughter, before the whole Batman thing, in the flashback, she says, "Mom says I can't live with you because you kill people." I don't know why that was written as a thing that a child would say to her father. It doesn't make any sense in terms of like sophisticated emotions being expressed or any kind of actual like conflict. It just sort of puts on the table the reason why she can't live with him because of that external limitation. But that shouldn't be coming out of her mouth.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any
sense.
It's
one of the many things in this movie that shouldn't need to be said because we understand who he is because we watched him argue with the bad guy on the phone and then put on his mask and then do a ricochet shot and kill that guy. Like, we know who he is. Like, we get even the smallest amount of subtext. So, like, you're okay not actually voicing things like that. You can leave that line out. We would still understand. All she has to say is, "Mom says I can't live with you." We know why. We're watching the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not like it's a subtle thing in terms of the expression of this. It's they talk about how he murders people through the whole picture. I don't think it was at any point questionable why they wouldn't live together.
Is it weird that I really just wanted a lot of people in the movie to say fewer words?
I want them to say more words that mean something. I want them to not say words that are just the same thing they already said.
Well, then you would have to write dialogue, though.
Yeah, I mean, writer-director David Ayer, as we've commented on in many other writer-director pairings, as that happens, sometimes you need someone else to check your work. And
do you think he demanded complete autonomy and like final cut on the script in order to take on this role?
No. Are you talking about
Not
Will
final
Smith?
Cut, that's the wrong word. No. I'm talking about David Ayer. Do you think he demanded to be to have final say on the actual script?
Well, considering he didn't have final say on any of this, I would say no.
I mean, he's the only credited writer other than the comic book source, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that he had final say on what the picture was.
Yeah. Just in terms of, like, there's nobody else cruising through the script and going, like, are you sure you don't want to phrase this in a way where, like, the way people would talk?
I mean, I would assume that he got notes from the studio at some point and worked them into his script. I don't know what those notes were. But at some point, the studio said, okay, you can go make this picture. with the understanding that he would make what was written down.
They probably had a release date before they hired him.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what I was saying earlier, is like, it's a trap. Like, when this Warner Brothers, like, as a studio, on the motion picture side, is a disaster when it comes to this stuff, where they're just, like, greenlighting things, canceling things, recutting everything. Like, there is no, like, coherent strategy to this stuff. And that's not just this picture. That is many other Warner Brothers pictures, especially these other DC pictures, which have all had some level of studio interference and mucking around, that have negatively affected the final outcome, regardless of whether or not it would have been a good picture if it had been released as is. So, you know, it doesn't matter that they agreed to make this, that he wrote and all that. If someone else had written this, then at least there would be some other person we could point to and say, maybe somebody wrote this terrible line of dialogue and it wasn't him. Or maybe when he was directing it, he'd go, oh, you know, this line of dialogue doesn't work. Let's just rework this part here, whatever. Or I'm going to hire in somebody for rewrites. No. He's like, I'm great. I wrote amazing stuff. I'm directing the amazing thing that I wrote. And that's it. And so that's what I'm saying. It's like, you need somebody to check your work. Because, like, if you're just making your own thing, then sure, you think it's great. But there's no, like, perspective on that, really. And, like, what the actual value of it is. I mean, God knows what Will Smith thought of it when he was reading this. But he chose to do this over Independence Day Resurgence. So that's something.
I'm going to say... correct decision.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Resurgence?
I have.
Okay. So just going through this whole check your work thing, I agree with you. I completely agree with you. This movie is bad, but also it is edited in a way that highlights the badness,
yeah.
rather than trying to minimize or hide some of it through some sort of creative editing. Like, it lingers on bad lines. Like, there are cuts that are seconds late where you're just like staring at something that should not be on screen anymore. You're like, what are you doing? And then there's also scenes that are just like, there's a scene playing out and it cuts 15 seconds forward every time to sort of make it the shortest possible scene it could possibly be. Like, you're watching a trailer and it's like, I live in an era of Red Bull and caffeine, and I can put this together in my head as I'm watching it. So I don't really need to watch every character walk from one side of the set to the other. Like, I can synthesize that in my brain, but every little bit of this is cut like a trailer, such that like you're jumping between space and time so much that it feels like a trailer. It doesn't feel like I'm watching a scene. And also the stuff in the trailer is boring.
Yes. Well,
I almost wish they would have Zack Snyder'd this and made the movie 70% slow-mo. It would have been more entertaining.
No, gross.
The slow-mo was the best-looking stuff, though. Then it would have been like an act. They would have been like, yeah, it's a trailer. We don't care. It's 2 hours of trailer.
But, I mean, we discussed this before. Like, a trailer house was brought in to recut this movie. And they focus group tested it, and it did better than Ayer's cut of the movie. But it wasn't... supposedly it was like his working cut or whatever. It wasn't like his final thing.
I'm sure it was flashier. I mean, it's just like, it's like adding a little extra sugar to your dish. Like, you know, people are gonna go like, yeah, that tasted more tasty. It had more taste to it than the other one. But on a larger scale, it's just like, it's gonna give you a headache.
Yeah, but somehow John Gilroy is the only credited editor on this. And John Gilroy, you'll remember, edited Rogue One the same year. I don't know what's going on with that. I don't know if there's any way to get really to the bottom of who made what choices in this, because it feels like such an amalgamation of.
Well, I think that's why we need to put all our cards on the table, and we really need to get the air cut out there in the public so the public can decide for themselves what actually happened.
No. Absolutely not.
I was kidding. I do not need a better or different cut of this movie. They are doing...
That's what you said earlier. You said there's a better cut that you could have.
There is a better version of this movie that could exist, but they don't need to waste time on it. As you said, it's not worth doing. But I also am going to regret saying this. They are doing what they should do, which is sweeping this under the rug and making a sequel to it that will hopefully be a lot better, but also probably won't be.
Yeah, I don't have the highest hopes.
Let's see. This one has a 5.9 on IMDb. Let's see what the new one was. 7.9, so 2 whole points higher.
Oh, yes. Well,
it must be because they brought in James Gunn, and James Gunn brought in his signature. One of the characters should be a weird-looking CG creature. So you got Fat Shark.
They brought in the big gun.
Is that Fat Shark's name?
No. They brought it. You know when they bring in the big guns, and they brought in the big gun at like two ends.
His name. Oh, that's stupid. Remember that for when we talk about the other one. That'll be a good title for that
sure.
one.
Sure. No, but they. I that was another thing about this whole process is the drama around it was known prior to this film's release, because there's also other stuff like Jared Leto was a method actor who decided that he was going to send dead roses and like Joker handwriting with lipstick and whatever to Viola.
Didn't he mail dog poop to people?
I don't remember everything he did. He just,
I think he mailed boxes of dog poop because, you know, really when you think of the clown prince of crime, as he's called, the Joker, this sadistic, crazy person, really what you imagine is sending dead flowers and boxes of poop to people.
Yeah.
He took that sort of like twisted childlike innocence of the Burton Joker and then just like gave him meth.
He's
bringing the clownness back to it, which doesn't help.
No, he's just messy. And he doesn't, the method acting didn't help him. And to your point, like, what would sending boxes of poop or dead flowers have to do with anything?
He sat on a lot of people's laps and got really close to their faces.
Like, Viola Davis is an actress who can act, and she doesn't need to, like, you know, kill subordinates in order to be able to act. Like, she doesn't need to, like, method act any of this stuff. She knows what she's doing. And, like, nobody else in this picture really needed to, like, live the experience of inhabiting the Joker and, like, going there. Like,
no, this movie is not constructed in such a way that if he were to really like become that character in these scenes, we're not going to linger on the people around him long enough to see how that's affecting them and whether or not it's actually drawing a real performance out of them. Like Ike Barinholtz tied to a chair in the kitchen of a underground poker game or something. Like that's not intimidating. We understand the transaction here. You're going to threaten Ike Barinholtz and he's going to do some stuff to help Harley Quinn or whatever. Like, we don't need that scene to be so hand-wringy.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward what's happening. But the Joker in this is so bad. How bad is he? And the Joker in this is so bad that he is not in... a spin-off movie that they were going to do. There was going to be a Joker movie that was this Joker, played by Jared Leto, and there was going to be the Joaquin Phoenix Joker that was going to come out first, but they were both still doing it at the same time. And this was back when Warner Brothers was doing stuff and everybody was just sort of scratching their heads, just like, is this like supposed to be anything coherent or whatever? You know, case in point, like we have the Matt Reeves Batman movie coming out with what's his face, Lighthouse guy, and like that doesn't integrate with this and stuff, but they're, you know, they're doing things are happening, and supposedly Michael Keaton is going to be involved in a different thing. Like it just seems incredibly messy what they're doing. This Joker is so bad that they canceled that Joker movie. It will never see the light of day. This Joker will not continue to go on and do stuff because nobody wanted it because it was so dreadful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
And while I think a more honed script centered around the Joker could have been interesting to see what Leto could have done, no, it's not worth taking the risk, especially after what we just saw here.
No, and I don't think he's good at anything, because, like, remember when he was in Blade Runner? Jesus.
I didn't hate him in Blade Runner.
Oh, he was so bad. He was the worst part of the movie.
He was doing a thing. But again, he was edited within an inch of his life in that movie such that he didn't, like, completely look like a turd in the punch bowl in that movie. Like, he fit, but just barely. In this movie, like, it's just like, here's all the Joker stuff that we didn't cut out of the movie. What do you think, guys? And we're like, can you try to, like, integrate it in a way that doesn't make it super weird and awkward? Every character in every scene, especially the Joker, has a dramatic entrance, and then it ends on just, like, him staring at somebody close in the face, like, threatening them. Like, can you do something else, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to write something for the Joker to have done.
And the sort of, like, the dialogue, the thing they tried to do with him is they tried to make him visually so insane and intimidating, which, whatever, not intimidating. Facial tattoos aren't intimidating. But then they tried to, like, infantilize his dialogue a little bit, where he's like, oh, I'm just going to hurt you. It's like, it doesn't land if we're not afraid of you. Like, you sort of underselling what you're about to do doesn't land if we don't have any understanding of the threat that you actually could potentially be. Just because you have a gold plate at AK-47 doesn't mean you're a threat. Like, you just, I mean, you look like an Instagram influencer with too much money who just kind of, like, went off the deep end.
A psychopathic crime boss and the nemesis of Batman, Leto described his role as nearly Shakespearean and a beautiful disaster of a character. About portraying the villain, he stated, "I took a pretty deep dive. But this was a unique opportunity, and I couldn't imagine doing it another way. It was fun playing these psychological games, but at the same time, it was very painful." Leto never broke his character throughout filming, with Smith going as far as stating he never met him. In preparation for the role, Leto spent his time alone, listened to gospel music from the 1920s, commenting he senses the Joker may be much older than people think, and read literature on shamanism. Influences for the character's appearance included the work of Alejandro Jodorowsky, and Joker's tattoos were added by Ayer, who believed it gave the character a modernized gangster look. David Bowie was also cited as an influence on the character by Leto.
Yeah. No. So here's the problem. When you say Shakespearean, what it's supposed to mean is that it's this eternal battle between good and bad and chaos and order. What it doesn't mean is holding your hand out in the air and speaking in incredibly dramatic, like, turns of phrase and then staring people down. You don't be Shakespearean by acting Shakespearean. Like, that's not what that's supposed to be. Well, it's supposed to be how you fit in with the story.
I would say it's not about, you know, dramatic good and evil. It's about human nature, and sort of the drama and tragedy of human nature. There's no drama and tragedy of human nature in this movie for this role. The sole exception being the very bad scene in Axis Chemicals where Harley Quinn, he asks her if she would die for him, and she says yes. And then he says, "Oh, this is too quick. Let me ask you a much more difficult question. Would you live for me?" And then she says yes, and then he convinces her to jump off into the vat of chemicals, and then he is about to walk away, and then decides that he actually really likes her, and then dives in to go save her and take her out of the vat of chemicals. I don't know why the movie did that at all. I mean, it's the only real, like, development sort of-ish adjacent tangential thing that is in this film of, like, he does care for her on some level, as opposed to it just being about her being a, I guess, possession. But it isn't articulated or communicated in any other point of the story, really. I mean, he rescues her, but in those rescues, it seems mainly about him getting back someone that is his, as opposed to like actual meaningful affection, because they don't display that affection towards each other, really, other than her calling him Puddin', and then him talking about how he's going to get her back, and that's it.
Yeah, and beyond just the context of this movie, I feel like I've seen, read, whatever, even some of the comic like source material about their relationship with one another. I understand like the basic mechanics of it. I still don't understand or believe the relationship. Like I don't know how they could have sold the relationship between the two of them to me in this movie or any movie. I don't think it really works very well, but that's me. Mm-hmm. But the only other thing I would like to add to that particular scene where she jumps into the liquid is that, again, Leto is being very air quotes Shakespearean. But he also, you know, he's doing like you said, oh, that was too quick. Like, let me think of something better. But he already knows what's better because like he doesn't actually look like he's thinking. It felt to me like they filmed a rehearsal, and that's what I was watching. I don't know how you felt about that scene, but it really didn't feel like anybody was, I mean, maybe Margot Robbie did pretty well, but he was not bringing his A game. And I like Jared Leto. I think he's a talented actor. Obviously he's won the Academy Awards. Okay. Fair enough. Whatever. I think he can be a good actor. He's not a good actor in this movie.
Get off the stage.
I'm not on the stage.
No, I don't care for him.
He's not everyone's taste. No. I'm not saying I love him. I'm saying he's a talented actor.
I've seen many roles where I've questioned what talent he could possibly bring to the table. I would say his best role that I actually think is fine is when he's in American Psycho. But the rest of the time I'm just like, ugh, this guy. Which is probably why he works in American Psycho, because you're like, ugh, this guy.
You should watch him in Panic Room. He's kind of a mix of that and something else.
Yeah, but then I have to watch the camera and go fly through walls and crap.
It doesn't happen for the whole movie.
It's just like fly through an air vent. Cheesy. But in terms of this film and like setting up this Joker, it didn't, and it ruined it. And so there's this sort of like trash fire of wreckage that was left after this film was made. And there's a surprising assortment of characters that have gone on to be in the Suicide Squad, which is the, as it was described, I believe, is a soft reboot of the franchise that exists.
All I'm hoping for is that we don't have another 40 minutes of character introductions. I'm sure we'll have a substantial amount because there are some new characters, but please let it be less bad than this one.
You got to introduce Polka Dot Man and King Shark.
Is that his character name, Polka Dot Man?
Yeah. Polka dots.
And then John Cena has a shiny hat on.
Yeah, the Peacemaker. I don't have high hopes.
Well, this movie was at the peak of DC attempting to create a extended cinematic universe planned 10 years in the future, just the way Marvel had done. And it seems after this movie, they stepped back to saying like, maybe let's baby steps it, you know, onesie twosie and see what we can do.
No, they didn't. Cause after this, they're like, yeah, sort of, let's power lunch on Tuesdays. Ba-ding, finger guns. Like they didn't really understand what went wrong, because then they went on to do Birds of Prey with Harley, which was somewhat well received by some people, but not.
They said, hey, people like Margot Robbie, let's make that movie.
Yeah. And then they had the terrible Justice League drama, which we've talked about many times, even though we didn't watch it. We have no intention of doing that.
I've seen the regular one.
Yeah, and some of this movie is hampered by the need to cross-promote in a very unnatural way, the Justice League movie that would be coming up after this, because we have that whole scene at the end with Ben Affleck and like the dossier, and it's, oh, there's a picture of Aquaman in it, and it's just like, oh, come on.
Was there a post credits here?
Yeah.
I tried to fast forward, but then my HBO Max app was just like, no, you're not allowed to fast forward. Then, oh, suddenly you're at the end of the credits.
Yeah, well, the Amanda Waller is having one of her trademark dinners with Bruce Wayne. And Bruce Wayne is all like, I'll protect you from the people coming after you, but give me the thing that I want. And she gives him this top secret file, and it's apparently like information on...
Oh, right. I think I've seen this. He gets like a USB stick or whatever.
No,
that's got some...
it's papers. The USB stick thing was in Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. The Wonder Woman finds the USB stick.
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, it's bad. But the, you know, you have that all going on, and then they made the Joker with Joaquin Phoenix, and then they had the Aquaman movie that went out, and then they're going to do another sequel to that Aquaman movie, which, God. And you've got just all this, like, this sort of, like, mess of things that are just constantly happening. And then the new Suicide Squad, which is the soft reboot, which kind of has some stuff, but kind of doesn't. Like, Idris Elba was going to replace Will Smith, but they didn't actually want to replace Will Smith. They wanted to leave room for Will Smith to come back. So instead, he's this character called Bloodsport, who is also in the comics, but is basically the same thing as Deadshot.
When I saw the trailers originally, I was like, are they just doing, are they just replacing Will Smith? Because he also gets the same, he gets to be the one to say the name of the movie in the movie, just like Will Smith was. And he's got guns and stuff and armor. So I was like, did they just do that? But then I looked at IMDb and I was like, no, he's a different name. So
he's, you know, he's got a daughter too, totally different guy.
Does he?
Yes.
Does he?
Apparently.
Oh,
according to the summary. I don't understand, like, the Warner Brothers executives are just so bad at this, like, just the revolving door of people who are just like, hey, what about this? Okay, bye, bow. I'm going to go over here.
We don't understand tone.
Yeah, like, so, and that was one of the issues with the production of this movie, was while this movie was being made, Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice came out and was not well received. And also, you had Deadpool come out, and it had a light, flippant tone that some executives liked. And so they wanted to lighten the mood of this movie and make it funnier. So I assume someone was brought in to punch up this or something. Like, I have no idea. But they have $22 million worth of reshoots on this movie. So they reshot a bunch of stuff. And then they still didn't like it at the end when they were trying to assemble a movie out of all of this. So... the Warner Brothers, just as an institution that is making things, has not learned any lessons from the process of making these other movies, and they continue to do this sort of, like, messy production process. I don't know if there's going to be any stories about drama or anything that comes out of the James Gunn thing. He seems real happy about it. He's been tweeting about it for months. It's insufferable. But if you are excited for that sort of thing, and it turns out to be good, maybe they'll make more of those sorts of things. But he is going back to Marvel now that they're not mad at him anymore for his bad tweets. And he's going to make Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Because the second one was so good, we needed a third one. And I don't know where that leaves them again, because then it's just like they're casting about for people to be involved in this stuff. Like Wonder Woman 84, it was Patty Jenkins again, but now she's off doing Star Wars stuff. So who's going to be in this stuff? There's nobody at the helm of this. It's just like this soup of people who like show up, get their stuff recut and messed with and produce some turd of a thing and then disappear into the ether. So I just don't understand what the overall philosophy of this is.
Well, at least they've got Zack Snyder in the producing role, to help sort of guide everyone into the same tone.
No, that hasn't worked. It hasn't helped anyone.
What?
Yeah. It didn't even help him.
You know, I'll be interested to see what James Gunn did in the sequel to this. I feel like he's just going to make a, I don't know, 40% better version of what we just watched. But I was not one of the people who absolutely fell in love with Guardians when I first saw it. And I think this Suicide Squad movie, the first one here, learned a lot of bad lessons from Guardians of the Galaxy. So hopefully they're just going to get the better version of their movie out of this. But I don't care. So.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I'm thankful for is that David Ayer was sort of classy about his interaction with James Gunn. It's like whatever that like Apple Notes non-apology thing was. Yeah.
Or was there like a handing off of the torch kind of thing?
Well, it was like a couple days ago. He tweeted out screenshots of text as one does. It was the basic summary is nobody's really seen his cut of the movie. It doesn't exist. It's not out there. And he really wishes that he could do that, but you know, it is what it is. And James Gunn is out here doing his own thing. So like, don't crap on him. And that's all he's going to say about that. And so I thought that was reasonably classy. He's not out there campaigning against James Gunn.
He doesn't feel like the sequel was stolen from him because the first one was sabotaged.
No, he turned down the chance to direct the sequel to this.
I mean, after if he had as much alleged studio interference as he claims, then sure, maybe he feels like it would just be another disaster. But whatever. Props for not taking the paycheck or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he was going to take a different paycheck. He was going to be doing another DC movie. It was something Gotham Sirens, and then that has been like parked. into a development maybe kind of position. So I don't know if that's ever going to be made now. So maybe he made the wrong choice in that, I guess, but maybe it was the right choice for all the rest
Gotham
of us.
Gotham City Sirens?
Yeah.
He's producing that. Apparently he's going to write Bright 2, which is a movie that I never saw.
Oof.
He directed that. Who wrote the first Bright?
Your
that
favorite. Max Landis.
Oh, was it Landis?
I believe it was.
Yeah, look at that. There he is.
Yeah.
You got Will Smith and then a
piece of trash
guy.
Yeah.
Never saw it.
Terrible human being, Max Landis. I didn't watch it either.
It was a Netflix movie or something.
Yes. I don't really, not to be a snob or anything, but if I ever see like Netflix action movie or Netflix comedy, it's like, oh, not a good use of my time on this earth.
Did you? I don't even know why I bother asking, but did you see Fury?
No,
I did. It's an unusual movie, even for a war movie. It's very sad.
Okay,
there's no positivity to it. That's another Ayer written and directed by, I believe. Yeah,
yeah, that's the one that had Shia in it.
Yeah, and Brad Pitt and. It was interesting in the same way that there were a lot of, you know, like Thin Blue or what was the Red Line? I can't remember. Whichever the movie was where it was just sort of like a sad art film about war or whatever. It's that, but like way darker. And I was like, oh, I saw that. Interesting. I would not have put that in as the same category as the guy who made Suicide Squad. But what do I know? Apparently nothing.
I mean, he's just
Just look at all these credits. It's hard for me to get a grasp of like what Ayer is good at.
He just does bro-y stuff. Everything's bro-y.
It's not just bro-y though. It's like,
I mean, even the artistic stuff is bro-y. Like
it's
all
like look how tough my characters are and mm-hmm. my situations are. But also like they're not overcoming the toughness. They're just like being sad in the toughness.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at here. Just like a bunch of.
But he wrote the Fast and the Furious.
Just a bunch of alpha shit.
Fast and Furious 1 is at the time, yeah, probably fits that bill. But my goodness.
Yeah, like, I don't think he was a good choice for this.
How many more years do we have to do this before we do all 9 Fast and Furious movies? 10 if you add Hobbs and Shaw.
30 years. I've only ever seen the first one and I didn't like it.
You got Paul Walker with his blonde curly hair.
Yeah, I know. I saw it. I didn't like it. And it and Noxuna Moon from The Mummy, right? She's in it, or is that somebody else?
I think it's somebody else.
Oh, shoot. Who's what is her name? Like her real actress name?
The Mummy. God, I can never remember her name too, because I think I get her confused with several people as well. Mm-hmm. She is Patricia Velasquez. Is she in one of the...
What's her IMDb
say? Fast and Furious movies? I'm scrolling.
Maybe she remember her from a different guest role or something? I don't know.
No. She was in some CSIs.
No. She should be more stuff. I liked her in The Mummy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
But anyway, it's been a really long time since I've seen The Fast and the Furious, and I did not like it. So there was... no rush on that one for any of the sequels.
There's an extraordinary amount of nostalgia in it now. Like it for a 20-year-old movie, my God, it feels 35 years old.
Yeah, well, of course.
Oh, Jordana Brewster is who you're thinking. She's Jordana Brewster. Sister.
Yeah, that is who I give me Easter for. Yeah.
I'm sure you're not the only person. David Ayer, my goodness. What a confusing man.
Yeah. I just don't need to know any more about him or see anything else he makes. Apparently
from Illinois.
Apparently this movie was scored by Stephen Price, which you would never know by the constant use of music inside of the film. And the cinematography is forgettable. Sorry.
It was dark.
Yeah.
You know, the little bits of graphics and stuff they did that were like, you know, the weird skull and crossbones kind of doodly neon eyes and stuff, like, again, I think there's something there with this like neon colored dirty bad guy thing, but like outside of the trailer of this movie they didn't really use it to any useful effect.
No, and it feels too art directed by someone with Photoshop as opposed to like any sort of it doesn't feel gritty. Like in a real sense, it feels very, you know, made to look, you know, toyetic or filmic or something. Like it doesn't seem like it is actually like a flow of things. But
at least they didn't use the doodles as like wipes to transition between scenes and stuff.
No, but was they had the other transitions, the animated things that they did that I didn't like. It made it feel like a music video. But yeah, I don't, this movie sucks.
Yeah.
Apparently in post-production, a lot of changes were made. The first 40 minutes of the film were, cut with sections of it potentially being used for the flashbacks in the film.
I saw that there. They took 40 minutes out of the opening of the movie and used some of it for flashbacks later.
Mm-hmm.
I fully believe that this movie was nearly 3 hours long. I mean, the assembly cut of this was probably 5 hours long because there's the way that the scenes are cut down to nothing and it's still 2 hours long. Yeah, there has to be so much footage missing.
Yeah, I mean, if most of your movie is going to be, and this is why this person is a bad guy, then you're going to be there for a really long time. there's also the third act was changed with the Joker originally having an influence within it, with the majority of Leto's scenes being cut from the theatrical cut, which upset Leto. Sorry, bud. Diablo would have originally survived the course of events in the film, which I think would have been better. I know they tried to. I know they wanted to kill him in order to like have it like have some more impact that somebody on the team died. He sacrificed himself or whatever.
He died for principle too. So he's showing the other bad guys what it means to maybe be a good guy.
Yeah, but nobody cares or will ever talk about him ever again. So it doesn't.
He's still absolutely a cartoon character in the movie.
It becomes meaningless in that regard. I thought his. Final fight thing, whatever, with the brother guy, who, as far as I know, never got a name. Just tall brother person. He got his butt kicked. And they had like a fairly interesting fight for one of these DC Snyder-esque things in terms of two CG things bashing into each other. Just because I've seen so many of these DC movies now where the camera's spinning around, at least it didn't do that. You know, just to have him go out in that sort of fizzle of glory, because also when the explosion happens, it just like, well, there's a hole in the floor now. Mm-hmm. That's it. Nothing else to talk about. Back to the list. Harley Quinn, Slipknot, Batman, Enchantress, and Katana originally had larger roles, with Katana having become possessed and attacking the team at one point. So that doesn't happen. A romance between Deadshot and Quinn was removed. Again, that would have been interesting in the film. Scenes showing Harley and Joker's abusive relationship were cut from the theatrical cut. I feel like there's plenty of it in there. A Killer Croc line was added for the theatrical cut without Ayer's input, which I believe is the I like him or something line. I don't know. Geoff Johns added Quinn being an accomplice to Robin's murder in the theatrical cut.
Yeah, I saw that here. Robin as in Batman and Robin?
Yes.
Is that in a line of dialogue somewhere that I glossed over?
It didn't register with me in anything that I saw on screen or heard. So all I can go by is what it says here on the Wikipedia page.
Somebody must have like fast talked it in one of the steak dinner scenes.
Yeah, with a mouthful of steak. Parts of the original score were replaced with pop songs for theatrical cut. The final cut was taken away from Ayer and instead handled to a trailer production company. Yeah, and the visual effects for this provided by Motion Picture Company, Sony Pictures Imageworks, Mammal Studios, all in VFX, and supervised by Robert Winter, Mark Breakspear, Gregory D. Lingi, Charlie Itriaga, and Jerome Chen as the production supervisor. I saw Jerome Chen's name really big. I worked on several of Jerome Chen's movies where he was a VFX supervisor when I worked at Sony.
His IMDb pages or Wikipedia page is amazing. Jerome Chen is a visual effects artist. In 2000, he was nominated for an Oscar for his work on Stuart Little. End of page.
Yeah, he's a person. And anyway, this movie, garbage, trash, garbage. Didn't ever need to see it. But I'm glad that I saw it for the context that it will bring for when I watch the soft reboot of this, or potentially Birds of Prey at some point. I don't know. You saw Birds of Prey. Is it worth watching Birds of Prey? Does it do anything?
I don't remember if there are any specific plot points that will be relevant to the next movie. I remember it being more enjoyable than I expected, but not markedly so. I don't think you will regret it as much as this movie that we just watched.
Okay. So do you think I should, like, if we were to do a progression of these things, should we do Birds of Prey next and then the Suicide Squad?
I think we probably should. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the things we do for you listeners.
Until next time.
Same bat time. Same bat channel.
Yeah.